Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231 lecture, and it's the 21st of October. So where are we on the schedule? We're going to get into central nervous system today, but I think I still have to finish up a couple things on fundamentals of the nervous system. Okay, you guys, am I going to have to turn this microphone up? Go ahead, step outside if you got to keep talking. Go ahead, step outside. You guys okay? Yeah, please. All right, so let's finish up nervous system. But where you want to start, right, is always start with this diagram right here and figure out where you are when you're looking at the nervous system. Right, so we're going to, later today, we're going to start over here with central nervous system. So if we look at the schedule, our next exam is on November 13th. And it looks like that's a Wednesday, because that Monday is a holiday, Veterans Day holiday. Okay, so that's going to be on a Wednesday, November 13th. And the chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 are going to be on that exam. Now, these chapters are a little bit shorter, except for 13. 13 is a little bit long. But all the rest of the chapters are pretty short. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over the schedule or anything like that? Okay, well, what do we have to finish up in, or just maybe even review what we did last time? Okay, we looked at some different kinds of neurons. How many different kinds of neurons did we look at? So you should know these neurons by their shape, and by their shape you should be able to tell me what the function is. Okay, so let me pull some examples up. Pretty good example. You have a nice table that shows all of this stuff. All right, so here we see the three kinds of neurons. Right, and these, here's a multipolar, here's the bipolar, here's the unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. And going in the reverse direction, pseudo-unipolar is for sensory. What's another name for sensory? Afferent information, and then here is the bipolar. Bipolar is for afferent information as well, but usually very sophisticated senses, like gustatory, hearing, vision senses use bipolar neurons. They're not too common in the body. And then these are the multipolar. I almost want to say these are the most common, but that might not be true, but they're certainly more common than the bipolar. And know the different pieces, right? Dendrite, cell body, axon, and the function of a multipolar, that should be easy because there's a bunch. All right, the pseudo-unipolar is sensory, and the multipolar is motor, okay? So motor or, and what's another name for motor? Efferent, yeah, efferent signals. And also, these neurons are for also our interneurons or association neurons that are found only in the central nervous system. And here is an example maybe of an interneuron. Nope, not there. Not there. I only have a pretty simple illustration of an interneuron, and that is right here. The very first slide that I showed you that shows you a response loop. And I said, what should you draw in? What should you pencil in? Right here, stimulus, right? And what does a stimulus always produce? A action, but maybe we would want to say response. Okay, so a stimulus always produces a response. Now, getting back to that association neuron, here it is right here. So this whole square kind of looks gray to me. This whole square represents the central nervous system, and here is that red neuron, who knows, and it is what? Completely within the central nervous system. The sensory and motor neurons are partly in the peripheral nervous system, here and here, but partly in the central nervous system, here and here. It's only the association neurons that are found completely and only in the central nervous system. Okay. What about a synapse? We looked at a synapse last time, and in particular a chemical synapse. What does a chemical synapse use to transmit information from one cell to another? Yeah, it uses a chemical, and generally we call that a neurotransmitter. And did you learn any specific examples of neurotransmitters? Yeah, acetylcholine, very common in the peripheral nervous system, and it's used in the central nervous system as well. Okay. Here are some terms. Just like for bones, we had to learn a bunch of terms, like a process, a foramen, meatus, condylar surface. So these are very powerful terms to know because they're very descriptive and they talk a lot about the nervous system. All right, so gray matter. Gray matter is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And that's because gray matter, if we look over here, gray matter doesn't have a myelin sheath around it. It's non-myelinated tissue. All right, so here we see an axon with a bunch of Schwann cells surrounding it. All right, and that's going to make this particular axon look a little white and not gray. Dendrites and cell bodies don't have any Schwann cells or myelination, and so they look gray even to the naked eye if we put enough of them together. All right, so gray matter is a group of cluster of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites. The cortex of the central nervous system, and is that the deeper superficial part of the brain, the cortex, deeper superficial. What about a bone? There's a medullary part and a cortical part for a bone. Which is the superficial one? The cortex, yeah. So the cerebral cortex is superficial. The medulla is always going to be the deep part. And the cortex in the brain is gray matter, which means that it doesn't have many axons that are myelinated. It's mostly what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And since it's the cortex, it's on the surface of the brain. All right, a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies deep inside the central nervous system. So I want you to pair up in your mind central nervous system with nucleus. And if we have many of them in the central nervous system, then we're going to call that those are the nuclei. So here we're using a term in a number of different ways. A nucleus could be what? Like inside of a cell that holds genetic material. Here's a sign sheet. Forgot to pass it out last time. Okay. All right, so a nucleus in terms of neuroanatomy is a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system someplace. And in particular, a good place for that would be the brain. Your book hasn't completely converted to this modern nomenclature. It's still called some nuclei in the brain ganglia. But strictly speaking, a ganglia is not found in the central nervous system. A ganglia is found in the peripheral nervous system, right? So a ganglion is just the same as a nucleus, except nucleus is in the CNS. Ganglion is in the PNS, or peripheral nervous system, and it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So what kind of matter is that? Gray matter or white matter? Okay. Since it's nerve cell bodies and dendrites, let's look at this slide over here. Do we see myelination around nerve cell bodies and dendrites? Indeed, we don't. So nuclei and ganglia will be gray in color. Yeah, gray matter. They're gray matter. And because of that, they're really easy to see. They stand out because usually they're surrounded by white matter. Okay, and that's our next term, axons with myelinated sheaths. Here we have white matter right here. And if we put in the central nervous system hundreds of these multipolar neurons all with myelinated axons together and say all these axons are going to the same part of the body, that group of axons that are myelinated in the central nervous system is what we call a tract, right? A nerve tract. So what color is a nerve tract? Let's look at this. It's going to be white matter. That's right. So white matter in the central nervous system, you should think of them as maybe a cable or a whole bunch of wires carrying information a long distance. All right. And just like nuclei and ganglia are different, a tract is in the CNS, we want to know what we call white matter in the peripheral nervous system, and that's just what we call a nerve. Right? So a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system, a tract is in the central nervous system. We'll use that even in lab quite a bit. Okay, we talked about continuous conduction, saltatory conduction. So let's look at a nerve. Right? And where are we going to find a nerve? Where are we going to find a nerve? We're going to find a nerve in the peripheral nervous system. Yeah, peripheral nervous system. Now, does the central nervous system have nerves? And the answer is no, it has something else. They're called tracts. They're called tracts in the central nervous system. All right, so here is, on the slide on the right, we have a nice illustration of what a nerve looks like. You can see it's a little bit more complicated structure than just a bunch of myelinated axons. All right, so this is going to be in the peripheral nervous system. As a matter of fact, a nerve has its own blood supply. A tract in the central nervous system does not, but a nerve in the peripheral nervous system does. And it also has some connective tissue sheaths that surround the axons. Right? So the thing that surrounds the whole nerve is the epineurium. And then the epineurium, we see there are bundles of nerve fibers in there. Those are what we call fascicles. Right? Just like for muscle, we had fascicles. And then there's some more connective tissue that separates the fascicles from each other. Those are that's the perineurium. Peri means just surrounding these fascicles. Right, and if we remove the perineurium, then we can begin to see some of the individual neuron axons. Okay, and there's another connective tissue sheath around that, right? And that's what we call the endoneurium. Right, so periosteum, you know, surrounded the bone. Endosteum was lining the inside. The same thing. Use that same nomenclature for this nerve. So if we remove that connective tissue, right, the endoneurium, then we see the Schwann cells, and then deep inside the Schwann cell is the axon. So that's how these things are bundled. Right, so this is a nice nerve. And where would we find a beast like this? What part of your body? What part of the nervous system? I'll give you a hint. What part of the nervous system? Peripheral nervous system, right? And tracts are a little bit simpler. They're found in the central nervous system. Okay, all right, we talked about basic neuronal organization, like a reflex or a response loop. And what does a response or reflex, what does it always start with? A stimulus, and what does it end with? A response, right? And so you should know what produces a response. This is probably a good time for me to mention that. What can produce a response? And the answer is an effector organ. So what are some effector organs? I know four of them that come to mind right off the bat. Okay, skeletal muscle is an effector organ, right? And that's part of what, the voluntary or involuntary nervous system? Voluntary, that's right. So we call that somatic motor or somatic efferent. And that's skeletal muscle. So we got three more kinds of effectors. We got glands. Can you control your glands voluntarily with your thought? No, you can't, right? They're controlled autonomically. What else besides glands? Smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. So smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, can you directly control them like skeletal muscle? The answer is no. Those are controlled also by the autonomic nervous system. So those are the four effectors that will produce this response when it receives a command from the integration center. All right, so if we look at this a little bit more, we see a stimulus can affect the receptor if the receptor is the right one, okay? And then it sends that information into the central nervous system via a sensory neuron. What is the shape of a neuron that is sensory? How many different shapes do you know about? You know three. Of the three, which one is this? This is the pseudo-unipolar, right? Pseudo-unipolar is a sensory neuron. That's going to share information with the integration center. The integration center has what kind of neurons by shape? They're going to be multipolar, and then those multipolar neurons will send the signal out to the effector organs via motor neuron. And what's the shape of a motor neuron? That's a multipolar as well. Okay. The only one we didn't mention is bipolar, because we're not looking at some special senses like eyes and things like that, but we will. Okay. Let's look at some processing that the nervous system can do to help us go about our daily lives. Okay, actually, I might want to show you this. Here's a response loop, but I don't see an association neuron right here. So here is the stimulus. This hammer is pounding the knee that stretches this patellar ligament, and there are stretch receptors in this ligament then that will send information, okay, send information into the central nervous system, right? Here's a, what we're going to learn to be the dorsal root ganglia. Here's a cell body of that unipolar neuron, and then this enters the central nervous system. So this is the central process. This is the peripheral process of that neuron. And I do not see an association or interneuron in this particular response loop, but the sensory neuron directly causes contraction of the quadriceps muscle, right, whenever that tendon gets pulled. And this is, so then the effect is going to be contraction of the quadriceps. And then here is that efferent motor neuron, and the quadriceps is the effector organ. Even the next slide. Ah, the next slide does have an association neuron. That's good. Okay, so here is, you know, this might even be an exam figure. So, number one is sensory receptor. But what should number one be? Stimulus. What's the stimulus on this illustration? Yeah, the pin is the stimulus, right? And you can only feel that pin prick your finger if you have what? A receptor for it. So here's the sensory receptor, and that's going to send information via the afferent neuron into the central nervous system. So here's the central process. This is the peripheral process of that unipolar neuron. It shares that information with the interneuron, and the interneuron then can make a decision on what to do, might share it with other association neurons in the spinal cord, and indeed that is the case. All right. And also it's going to stimulate, all right, via this efferent neuron, contraction of the biceps, right? And then what happens when the biceps contracts? Okay, it produces a response by withdrawing your hand from that painful stimulus, or even better way to think it, that damaging stimulus, all right? So think of the stimulus as being damaging. Okay, yeah.
Would that response be involuntary or voluntary?
Even though, yeah, you know what, even though there's skeletal muscle, this right here, any kind of signal processing and control of the skeletal muscles at the level of the spinal cord happens without your conscious thought, right? So I can't really say it's a voluntary, something that's happening voluntarily, even though these are skeletal muscles, right? So your spinal cord can make a lot of decisions for you. Before you even know about it. Like if you grab a hot pan from the stove and your finger is starting to burn, you've already dropped the pan and you're retracting your hand from that damaging stimulus before you even know that your hand is burning, okay, because of this kind of processing within the spinal cord. So what this also says, then, this interneuron that we see right here within the spinal cord is also sharing information with a sensory tract, which is going to take that information to your brain so that you can actually make some conscious decisions on what to do, right? Like if that pan was on fire, then you'd probably do other things, like you might run out of the house as well as drop it, okay? Yeah, question. So this is a reflex, yeah. So this is a reflex, and this is a nice reflex at the spinal cord level, okay? And if it's a damaging stimulus like this, this association neuron might send signals over here to contract other muscles, right, the extensor muscles in the other arm, so that you'll be pulling away from the damaging stimulus, and with the other arm you'll be pushing away from it. So there's all kinds of reflexes that can happen within the spinal cord. Oh, but here's something else I wanted to mention about that voluntary action. If you know that somebody's going to stick a pin right here, maybe a lancet or something, you can inhibit this response to some degree, okay, if you know it's going to happen. If you don't know, then probably you can't stop the reflex. But for instance, a lot of diabetics have to sample blood by putting a lancet in their finger to get a little drop of blood, and of course they don't draw their finger away every single time because they know it's going to happen, and then they can voluntarily inhibit this reflex. Okay, so it all depends. So your question has a lot of different answers, depending. Okay, so let's look at some signal processing. I talked about this interneuron right here, maybe sharing information. How can it share information? Well, let's just say here is that interneuron once again, and there is a trifurcation within the axon, and this one interneuron can share information with three other kinds of pathways or neurons, right? And each one of those can share information with more neurons, right? And I think I mentioned that before. This is what we call a diverging circuit, like that interneuron that's going to cause contraction of the biceps, but it's also going to send information to the brain, right? So that would be an example of a diverging circuit, sharing information to various parts of your body, right? That's diverging, sharing of information, diverging. Converging, here we see three neurons all converging on one central neuron. And this is, remember, every neuron can act like and makes a decision. Okay, it's an integration center. So what I see right here is this neuron is integrating information from a number of different sources in your body. It could be different senses, right? It could be maybe conscious thought. It could all affect the activity of the output from this central neuron. All right, maybe a really good example of that would be every once in a while they test the fire alarms here, right? And you'll hear the fire alarm. But if I tell you ahead of time they're just testing the fire alarm, we don't have to leave the building, then of course this neuron is going to do what? It's just going to keep taking notes, right? Because we know to ignore that fire alarm if they're just testing it. But now what happens if you hear that fire alarm and maybe see a flashing light? All right, so now you have that other neuron bringing information into this output right here. Well, you might consider, well, gee whiz, maybe they're not just testing the fire alarm, but maybe they are, so let's just sit here. But now let's consider a third stimulus. What about if you hear that fire alarm, okay, and you see the flashing light, and I told you they're just testing the fire alarm system, but you smell smoke from this neuron right here. Then what do you think you're going to do? Keep taking notes? The room starts to fill up with smoke, then chances are this neuron is going to make a different decision, right? You'll leave the room. Or if you smell smoke and see flames, right, then this other information won't be quite as important. So this is what we call a converging circuit, where information from various parts of your body come to make a decision on what you should be doing. The last kind of processing unit I see right here, I see 1, 2, 3, 4 neurons all in a row. We call that a series of neurons. They're all in a row. We have neuron number 1 stimulating number 2, number 2 stimulates number 3, number 3 stimulates number 4. Okay, but I do see something else that's interesting. Number 3 and number 4 right here have a bifurcating axon, right? And the bifurcating axon goes back to some of the previous neurons. Right, so here is a branch from number 4, here's a branch from number 3. So this neuron right here is integrating information from these two neurons, and then it's going to share it with these two neurons here, number 2 and number 3. All right, so what I see here is a convergent pathway. I see a divergent pathway as well, right? And this forms a loop all around like this. So you might be wondering, well, what good is this loop? If we stimulate it one time, then these signals might run around in this loop for a long period of time. What possible good could that be? So does anybody have an idea of what kind of circuit in your brain might use this kind of activity? Okay. Pain. You know, there might be some pain pathways that are like this. Sometimes pain is really hard to treat, right? So maybe you feel that pain stimulus and it just reverberates for a long time, so even analgesics won't block that reverberation of pain feelings. Right. But a really common one would be a part of the brain called the reticular activating system, and it's responsible for keeping you awake. After you wake up in the morning, right, you hear that alarm clock, and here's that neuron that gets information from your ears. You hear alarm clock, stimulates the reticular activating system, and that keeps, right, stimulating the reticular activating system, and in so doing, that keeps you awake. Right, for at least a little while, until this neuronal pathway here gets fatigued, and then of course what happens when these neurons fatigue? Then you fall asleep. Right? So this is a good example for arousal, this reverberating circuit. And sometimes people might have damage to this reticular activating system, we're going to see where it is in just a second, a certain part of the brain. So if these neurons are damaged, once somebody wakes up, what can happen to them? Almost immediately, they can fall back asleep again, right? And what do we call that? Somebody knows what that's called, I'm sure. Yeah, that's narcolepsy, right? Narcolepsy. Sometimes we have no idea why it's happening, and therefore it's really hard to treat. And that person's life is really messed up when that happens. Probably you don't have a driver's license, okay? Can't walk around without a helmet on. Really terrible stuff. Okay, don't forget, sign-in sheet is going around someplace. If you came in late, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. All right, disorders of the nervous system. We're not going to talk too much about that, but one particular example that we're all familiar with, remember there are many neurons in your brain and even peripheral nervous system that are myelinated. So what are those cells that myelinate axons in the peripheral nervous system called? Those are Schwann cells, okay? And what's the counterpart in the central nervous system? What are they called? Those are oligodendrocytes, remember? And those speed up the rate of an impulse conduction down an axon. And in a condition called multiple sclerosis, the oligodendrocytes atrophy and actually put down plaques around an axon. Right? So when there's degeneration of the myelin sheath in a part of somebody's brain, okay, we call that multiple sclerosis. And the timing of these neurons and how they share signals gets disrupted. And information doesn't get to the right parts of the brain at the right time. And there can be all kinds of abnormalities with somebody with multiple sclerosis. One fortunate thing is that sometimes it goes into remission spontaneously. And somebody can get their normal life back for a little bit, and then maybe it becomes active again. And so there's no way that we can cure multiple sclerosis, but there are some treatments that can elongate the periods of remission and decrease the length of time of those active stages. So we just call that control, right? So we can control multiple sclerosis for in a little way, but we can't completely cure it yet. So that's a really good example of disorder of a nervous system. We talked about if there's a stroke or something in the reticular activating system as well. Okay, so that's it for an introductory chapter to nervous system. And so know the different kinds of neurons, know something about this nice reflex loop, the different kinds of pathways, how you put a nerve together. What else did we look at? Oh, the synapse. That's right. Don't forget the synapse. That's real important to know that synapse. All right, so I'm going to put this chapter away. And I'm going to put this chapter away. And that, I closed it out. Hopefully we don't need to go back to that. And then go on to the central nervous system. Okay, well, we got to remember, what is the central nervous system? What is the central nervous system? Yeah, it's that brain and spinal cord. Oh, here's a figure hiding out right here. Okay, and I see a little bit of the brain right here, and I see spinal cord. So here is a nice picture of the central nervous system, and I see some nerves leaving the spinal cord. So these nerves right here are no longer in the central nervous system. They're in the peripheral nervous system, and that's why we call them nerves. If these myelinated axons were in the spinal cord, we would call it, what would we call these myelinated axons in the spinal cord? We can't call it a nerve because that's peripheral nervous system. But what do we call those things in the central nervous system? Myelinated axons, those would be tracts, right? Those would be tracts. Okay. All right, so the brainstem. Brainstem is about in this region right here. It starts right at the foramen magnum. And I got to get a nice picture for you of what the brainstem looks like. Okay, here's one view of the brainstem. All right, so here is about where the foramen magnum would be, right? And that's right at that big hole in the occipital bone. Down below, inferior to the foramen magnum, is going to be the spinal cord. And then everything superior to that is going to be the brain. And the first part of the brain is the brain stem. And the brain stem includes the medulla oblongata and the pons, these two structures right here. All right, so that's the brain stem. And that's where that reticular activating system is that keeps you awake. It's in this part of the brain. In an evolutionary sense, this is the oldest part of our brains. So it controls many autonomic functions in us, just like it does very primitive kinds of animals, like lizards and frogs and things like that. Okay. So what are some of the things that the medulla in particular regulate? Well, we got heart rate. So the cardioregulatory center is right inside the medulla. And it also helps regulate blood pressure by causing blood vessels to constrict or to dilate. Right? And so we call that the vasomotor center is in the brainstem, in particular the medulla. The respiratory center is located within the pons and the medulla. They work together to regulate breathing so that we don't have to think about breathing all the time. But if somebody gets a stroke, right, or damage to the pons or medulla, just like somebody could get narcolepsy, they might not be able to breathe automatically. That means that every breath they take, they have to consciously think about. Right? And that's really too bad when that happens as well, because then you have to be on a respirator when you are sleeping. Otherwise, you won't breathe when you're asleep, right? Because you don't have any conscious thoughts when you're sleeping. Does anybody know what that pathology is called? It's pretty rare. It's called Odin's curse. Odin's curse is when you have to voluntarily take every breath that you're taking. It just doesn't happen automatically because there's damage to the respiratory centers in the brain stem. Okay, so what else? Swallowing, vomiting, coughing, sneezing. These are all located right here in the pons and the medulla. Okay. Pons we kind of talked about already, but another important function of the pons, so here I see the pons superior to the medulla. I can see, right, some pathways that are coming from this anterior part of the pons, and it's wrapping around into this posterior section right here, and that's what we call the cerebellum. Right, the cerebellum is important because it coordinates voluntary muscle motion in your body. So, for instance, if you are walking down the sidewalk and you accidentally trip on something, the cerebellum can make corrections very quickly so that you don't fall, right, and hurt yourself. That's part of the job of the cerebellum, and signals get into the cerebellum from the spinal cord via the pons. And that's why sometimes we say the pons is a relay center. It can relay information from the spinal cord into the cerebellum, in particular, motor activity. Okay. I want to find 14A right here. All right, here's another view of what we're talking about. So here is the spinal cord. So here's foramen magnum. This first bump that we see within the midbrain, this is the medulla oblongata. The second bump that we see is the pons. Right, so pons and medulla make up the brain stem. This is a nice, anybody know what kind of section this is through the brain? Yeah, it's a nice sagittal section. Right, and then here is that cerebellum that I was just talking about, and signals get into the cerebellum because the pons wraps around this part of the brain and sends these tracts into the cerebellum. Okay. Midbrain. Let's take a look at the midbrain. So we got spinal cord, we've got the brainstem with medulla and pons, and in this area right here, this is what we call the midbrain. And the midbrain has these two little bumps. We see two bumps on one side, and there's two bumps on the other side. So together there are four bumps, and we call these the corpora quadrigemina, these four bumps right here, just right above the cerebellum. And their function is pretty interesting. But again, signals in this area right here, just like in the spinal cord, don't raise or go all the way to the level of consciousness, right? But there are important reflexes that are established within these two bumps The bottom one is called the inferior colliculus. The top one is called the superior colliculus. All right, so you got two superior colliculi, two inferior colliculi, and they make the corpora quadra gemina. Okay, so what are these for? Let's talk about the inferior pair right here. This is for localizing sound. What that means is when you hear a sound, okay, without seeing where the object is, the inferior colliculi can tell you where that sound is coming from. Like you all could try to trick me right now. You could say, hey, close your eyes, and I'll close my eyes, and then somebody will open and close the door, right? And what would I be able to tell you? If it's the door over here in the front on the right, the door over here in the front on the left, the door in the back on the right, the door in the back on the left. Because depending on what door opens and closes, sound will reach my head, okay, at different times. If the sound is coming from my right, it's going to hit my right ear before the left ear, and the inferior colliculus will be able to time that difference, and will say, oh, for sure, the sound is coming from your right, or your left, or in front of you, or in back of you. All right, so that's what its job is. It localizes sound. All right, and again, that's without your conscious thought. So if it's a really loud sound, okay, you might be able to get out of the way of what's ever producing that sound from some direction, right? So that is helpful. So you can respond to sound stimuli even though you're not thinking about it, which occurs in the cerebral cortex, which is where I'm circling with the cursor right now. The superior colliculus also processes information from important sense organs, but it's not your ear, it's from your eyes, right? So the superior colliculus contains a lot of optic reflexes. So that if I have a piece of paper and I throw it, okay, and you can tell if that piece of paper is going to hit you or not, right? Because your eye will be able to track. So visual tracking is an important function of the superior colliculus. And even if I put a little spin on it, right, and it starts to curve around, right, you'll still be able to track that object because of the superior colliculus. And again, that's without your conscious thought. And that's kind of interesting. Where does your conscious thought take place? We're going to get to that, but it's from the cerebral cortex, way up over here, way up on top of the superior colliculus. There was an interesting case a number of years ago in Florida, and there was a woman who was comatose, right? And as a matter of fact, clinically, she was described as brain dead. And she had a life insurance policy, and maybe it was a criminal matter. They didn't really know for sure. Her husband said that she just overdosed on drugs and stopped breathing, right? But her parents said, oh, no, that's not what happened. She never abused drugs. It was her husband that beat her up that caused the damage. And they could never prove it one way or the other. And so they didn't really know if they should take her off of life support or not. Right? Because there was a doctor that came in and with a pencil held it up in front of, her name was Terry Schiavo, held it up in front of her eyes, and her eyes, it appeared as if her eyes were looking at the pencil, right? And then if the doctor moved the pencil, that then Terry's eyes would move, would track it around. So it really obvious that the eyes were looking at a pencil, right, or looking at something and tracking that information around. Okay. The MRI exams, CT scans show that the cerebral cortex had basically turned to fluid. Okay, it was no longer there. So she had no idea she was looking at anything, but how was it that she was able to track that pencil around? Because the superior colliculus was still functioning to some degree. All right, so that's probably not a really good reason to keep somebody on life support, right? If the rest of their brain has turned to fluid, I certainly wouldn't want to be kept on life support just because my superior colliculus was producing a reflex that to some people looked like I was actually thinking about a pencil, right, which I wasn't. And it was kind of amazing that a physician actually would say that. Okay, probably got a lot of money to say that in court. Okay, so know something about these colliculi. All right, then also part of the midbrain. Let's see, what else do we have? Midbrain. Okay, I see a little something that looks like a river or a stream, and indeed it is. There's some fluid flowing through there. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But go across that stream into this part where I have the cursor now. Right? Here is a large bunch of neuronal tissue that is taking signals from the spinal cord up to the cerebrum, or signals from the cerebrum back down to the spinal cord. So it's a huge connection, right, between the brainstem and the cerebral cortex, and it's basically a big important bridge that's connecting those two parts of the brain, and we don't call it a bridge in neuroanatomy, we call that a peduncle. I don't know if anybody's ever used that term before in here, but here is a peduncle. Connects major parts of the brain, and it's huge. Right, so here is the cerebral peduncle because it's taking information to the cerebrum. All right, we also said earlier that the pons is connected to the cerebellum. So there's got to be a bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. And what did we call a bridge again? A peduncle. That's right. So there are peduncles down over here, but we don't call those the cerebral peduncles. We call those the cerebellar peduncles because here is the cerebellum. All right, and information can't go back and forth if those peduncles are damaged. All right, so this is the midbrain. We got these three components, right? Actually, maybe two components, the cerebral peduncle and the corpora quadrigemina. That's ignoring the individual names for the corpora quadrigemina. It's also ignoring this little aqueduct as well, but that's also in the midbrain. Okay. All right, reticular formation we talked about already. In between the medulla and the pons. All right, so that pretty much finishes up everything in the brainstem. All right, so this is all what we consider the brainstem, not the cerebellum. All right, so here we have some more brain tissue. This is what we call the diencephalon. The diencephalon has got two main regions. It's got the thalamus, and you can see it's kind of globular, looks like a one big lobe inside the brain. And people describe it as looking like a walnut. It's about the size of a walnut. And then there's some more neuronal tissue below the thalamus. All right, so what kind of term would you use in anatomy to describe something below another? Hypo, like hypodermis, for instance. All right, so here is the hypothalamus. So you got thalamus and hypothalamus make up the diencephalon. Okay, one of the most important jobs of the thalamus right here is that before signals from sensory receptors in your body, before they can go to the cerebral cortex, for you to appreciate what those senses are, they have to pass through the thalamus. All right, so the thalamus also acts as a relay station. Sensory signals or afferent signals come up the spinal cord into the thalamus, and then the thalamus directs it to a particular part of the brain, right? And for instance, if it's auditory information, it's going to go to the temporal lobe. If it's visual information, it's going to go to the occipital lobe. I'll show you a diagram of where those things are in a second. And it's the job of the thalamus to direct those signals to one part of the brain or the other. All right, the thalamus is involved with mood and generalized pain. It can be activated by mood-enhancing drugs, for instance. The hypothalamus right here is important for a lot of autonomic functions, just like the medulla and the pons, but probably not quite so primitive kinds of things, like regulating body temperature, right? The amphibians and reptiles really don't regulate body temperature, but mammals do, so the hypothalamus of mammals is a whole lot more sophisticated. This is the part of the brain that tells you when you're thirsty, for instance, or when you're hungry. And it also can monitor a number of hormones inside the body. And when we get to the endocrine system, we'll see that there's a nice connection between the hypothalamus and a gland that's right underneath it, and that's the pituitary gland. All right, so part of the pituitary gland is controlled by the hypothalamus, and the pituitary gland controls many, many endocrine systems in your body. All right, so that's another important part of the hypothalamus. All right, cerebrum. Right above the diencephalon, this is the largest part of the brain. So here is the cerebrum, and it's got a number of different lobes. Okay, so here is the most anterior one. We're going to call that the, what bone is it underneath? the frontal bone. So here's the frontal lobe. Then we have a lobe back over here underneath the occipital bone. So this is the occipital lobe. And then here's a part that's under the parietal bone. This is the parietal lobe. And what we can just barely see, there's another one underneath the temporal bone that's way lateral, and I see it poking out right here. This is the temporal lobe. Right? Temporal lobe is very lateral. Okay, if we look at the surface of the cerebrum, does it look like it's flat or is it all wrinkled up? It's all wrinkled up. Yep, and those wrinkles are what we call gyri, right? And one is a gyrus. And a gyrus has a couple different components, right? There's a depression, that's what we call a sulcus in anatomy, right? And then there's this raised area right here, and that's what we call a gyrus, right? And then here's another depression, that's a sulcus, right? So if you put a number of sulci together with a number of gyri, then we have something called a convolution. A convolution, okay, is made up of all of these sulci and gyri all put together. Right? What does convolution mean? Convolution just means something that has lots of twists and turns in it. Okay, that's really all that means. All right, so you might be wondering, why is our cerebral cortex all folded up like this? Okay, and that's a really good thought to have. Okay, humans have the most gyri compared to any other kind of organism. Okay, and the reason is that intelligence or signal processing power is directly related to the surface area of the cortex. How big is the cerebral cortex in an animal relative to their body size? Okay, so the bigger your brain is compared to your body size, the better the brain you're going to have. And what evolution has figured out, okay, let's have this piece of paper right here, which is 8.5 by 10. It's a pretty big piece of paper. How can I get this piece of paper to fit in a smaller space? Which would be really good, because I wouldn't like my head to be like 8.5 by 11, right? Okay, or like that, right? But how can we get this 8.5 by 11 piece of paper in a smaller space? Yeah, I'm not going to, if I fold it, we could get it really small. I won't really fold it. I'll just kind of crinkle it up like this just to give you an idea. All right, so now you see what? A lot of convolutions, okay? Now, what about this piece of paper? Is it still 8.5 by 11? Yeah, it's still 8.5 by 11, but what? It's fitting in a smaller space because of it has been convoluted, right? So the depressions are the sulci. The ridges sticking out are the gyri, okay? So that's why we have all of these convolutions here. The frontal lobe. This is some good basic information for you to know. The frontal lobe is a lot like your car, at least most people's cars. Okay, what do you have in your car? Or suppose you have a car. I don't know if everybody has a car, right? But suppose you have a car. What do you have in the front of your car? You have a motor. Okay, so that's a really good idea, a really good concept to just transplant into this brain right here, because the frontal lobe is responsible for controlling motor activity in your body. As a matter of fact, somatic motor. Right? And what is somatic motor? It means voluntary motor. What kind of effector organs give you voluntary control? Skeletal muscle, right? So the frontal lobe controls, or electrical activity, right, is initiated in the frontal lobe to control skeletal muscle because it's the primary motor cortex. All right, so because of that, there are also some areas that are really complicated that are motor areas for speech that allow you to move your tongue and your cheeks and to breathe just right so that you can articulate. Right, so that's a special area of the brain. I'm going to probably show you where that is in just a second. Okay. And maybe now is a good time to show you. And that's what we call Broca's area. Broca's area is important, okay, for speech. And speech means that you should be able to listen to a language as well as speak the language. All right? But Broca's area is important for what? Speaking or listening? For motor or sensory? You're going to say motor, because the frontal lobe is the motor cortex in your body, right? All right, so don't get tricked with that. Let me see if I can find example of where some of these things are. in the brain. Oh, I don't have arrows. Where are they at? Okay. So here we have the brain. Let's just look at some of the overall architecture of the brain once again. We haven't talked about all of it, but maybe most of it. All right, so here is the cerebrum, right? That's the largest part of the brain. And here is the, what lobe is this? Frontal lobe, and then we have, this is all frontal lobe still, but then we have the parietal lobe over here, because this central sulcus is separating the frontal lobe from the parietal. Right, so ignore these colors. I want you to find this central sulcus. So here's parietal, and then occipital lobe is over here. And then finally, here is that lobe that we couldn't see very well before. This is the temporal lobe. Right, so here are the lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal. And here is the separation between the frontal and the parietal lobes. So frontal lobe is motor. This area right here is important. This is Broca's area, right? So this is important for speech, right? So the rest of the brain is important for sensory, processing sensory information, like the occipital lobe has the primary visual cortex, right? The temporal lobe has the primary auditory cortex, right? So when you're listening to language, okay, what are you doing? You're probably looking at somebody, right? As long as you don't have any vision deficits, you're listening to somebody, right? So vision information is going to this visual cortex, and then it's passed up over into this area. When you hear stuff, right, then it goes to this area over here, and this area right here will actually tell you it's a language, just not a bunch of random noises, okay? Or maybe some other kind of information, maybe like music, right? But this is the language center of the brain. We call that Wernicke's area, right? Because it gets information from the primary auditory cortex and primary visual cortex. And let's just say that somebody has a stroke in the brain, and when somebody has a stroke, a part of their brain dies, and let's just say it's Broca's area that gets a stroke. What can you tell me about a person that has a stroke only in Broca's area in terms of language? Okay, speech, what does this mean? Okay, what are the two components? Yeah, speaking and listening. Oh, that's what you mean by speech, sure. All right, but can that person still listen and understand a language? Yes, they can, right, because Wernicke's area is just fine. So that's pretty strange, right, that somebody can understand language, right, but can't participate in it because there's a lesion here in Broca's area. If it's the other way around, then somebody would be able to speak but not understand, okay, what somebody is communicating with them. They might understand what they're communicating, but, okay, they won't be able to respond to auditory questions, okay? And maybe with practice they can overcome that. If they're in, I don't know, about visual information, they might not be able to read even, okay? So it all depends on how much of this area is affected. Okay, so these are the major lobes of the brain. Ah, one other thing with the frontal lobe. Okay, let's look at this central sulcus. Here's that central sulcus, and that's the separation between the frontal and parietal lobes. I see a gyrus right in front of the central sulcus, and so we call that the precentral gyrus. The precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex. This is what controls the skeletal muscles in your body. The other areas, right, of the frontal lobe, like the prefrontal cortex that we have right here, okay, is where we solve problems or look at our environment and learn how to act properly, appropriately under various kinds of circumstances, right, within the prefrontal cortex. And we have working memory in this area. We can remember spatial tasks. And solving complex problems, okay, like how to act properly depending on your circumstances. In psychology, they talk about this area quite a bit, and they give an example. I don't think this example is given in your book, but there was somebody that was working on a railroad a number of years ago, maybe 100 or 200 years ago, probably not 300, but long time ago, right? And when they were putting the railroad in, they had to use dynamite to make a path through the mountains. And so they would drill a hole, stick dynamite in the hole, and then use a big metal rod and pack the dynamite into the hole so that it would blow up a bunch of rocks. But there's a guy by the name of Phineas Gage. When he was packing the dynamite into the hole, guess what happened? The dynamite exploded, and the hole became like a gun, and it launched that big metal bar right between the rami of his mandibles, up through the frontal lobe, and then out through the top of his head. And he survived that, but the frontal lobe was damaged, right? And so before that accident, he was a very good employee. Show up to work right on time. He could remember what he was doing and how to do certain things, except I guess packing dynamite, forgot how to do that. Worked well with coworkers, but after the accident, right, he was no longer the same person because he was very argumentative, never showed up to work on time, and started to act very inappropriate. All right, so that is just some evidence of what the function of the prefrontal cortex is. Okay. Okay, parietal lobe. Oh, all right, so here is what? This is the precentral gyrus. This is the primary motor cortex. All right, well, what can you do with a primary motor cortex? What can you do with that? That's a pretty good question. What can you do with that primary motor cortex? Let me go back to a previous slide. Well, I guess here we are. So this premotor cortex is like a red color, right? Okay, and then right posterior to it, we got something that maybe looks a little blue to me. But let's try to remember these colors, red and something that's kind of bluish. All right, and so what did we say? We want to look at the red color first, which is what? The precentral gyrus right here. And what we understand is that that controls various muscles in your body, and it's in a very special arrangement. So right on the top of your head right here, this controls muscle in your trunk. If we go down into this depression, all right, the separation between the cerebral hemispheres, then this is the area that controls leg muscles. Right. And then if we move a little bit farther away from midline, past the trunk, and into this area right here, here is a very large area that controls the hand. Because you have a lot of muscles in the hand, you have a lot of dexterity. Unlike, for instance, your back. Right? You don't do a lot with your back. Those muscles either contract so that you can sit up straight or they don't. But in your hand, you can undergo all kinds of very fine muscle motion, and that's true because why? There is a large part of your cerebral cortex that is dedicated to that particular task. Right. The same thing for your face. Look at this large part of the cerebral cortex that controls facial expression and eating and breathing, right, and swallowing. Right. So this red area corresponds to the primary motor cortex, and this little person right here is what we call a homunculus. So here's a little homuncular diagram. And let's just say somebody had a stroke in the primary motor cortex, right, that's right in front of the central sulcus, in this region right here. What would be the effect? What would be the effect? Could they see? Could they see? Could they see? Could they see? Okay. I tried to trick you because this area is for skeletal muscle, okay, and not sensory, just motor control. So what has somebody lost the ability to do? Yeah, like to open and close their eyes, right? Just that, but they can see just fine. Because the part of the brain that's necessary for vision is the occipital lobe. We're going to get to that a little bit later, okay? So a little bit of an unfair question, but I'm glad we talked about it. But if somebody had a stroke in this part, okay, of the primary motor cortex, what would happen? They'd lose control, motor control of their tongue, and that would be really difficult, right, because then you couldn't swallow, couldn't communicate, maybe have a hard time breathing. Okay, so this is a little homuncular diagram. All right, let's look at this blue area. All right, where's the blue area? Here's the central sulcus. What's right behind the central sulcus? What color is that?
Blue.
Okay. Okay, so This is what we call the post-central gyrus. It's a gyrus, right, because it's a raised area. And this is the primary somatosensory area of your brain. This is where you can feel sensation on the surface of your body. That's generally what we call your somatic body, as opposed to visceral sensation, which is deep inside body cavities. So if somebody touches your nose, you can feel it because of neurons in this region of your brain, right, the post-central gyrus, or your belly button, or your kneecap, or whatever, right? This is where sensory information is realized, right, in this part of the brain. And it's arranged, right, just like the primary motor cortex. There's a little homuncular person, right, and you can see this area. You can feel sensation on your foot. And here is sensation on your hand, and here is sensation on your face. So you can see you have a lot of receptors on your face for sensation. Right, teeth, tongue, a little bit, but that's not really taste. That's just sensation on your tongue, like hot, cold, damaging stimulus, things like that. Okay, and notice there's a nice relationship between, okay, where this information is being processed, like the hand for motor, hand for sensory is in the same location, but it's on a different gyrus. Right, this is the post-central gyrus. Here is the precentral gyrus. So don't forget, where do you have the motor in your car? In the front, right? Anybody have an engine in, not in the back, not in the front, but right in the middle of your car? Anybody have a car like that? Engine right in the middle? Okay. Oh well, I won't ask to borrow your keys then. That would be fancy. Okay, let's talk about, so we talked about the parietal lobe a little bit. Okay, so that's for sensory, in particular somatosensation on the surface of your body. Here is that occipital lobe, pretty much dedicated to processing visual information, right? And then here is the temporal lobe, and it processes auditory information. So everything posterior to the central sulcus, in one way or another, in the cerebrum, okay, is for what? Motor or sensory? Is sensory, right? Would be one thing or the other. All right, well, all of the nerves in this nervous system, whether it's peripheral nervous system or central nervous system, all use the same language. It's called an action potential. It's a little voltage that moves along a neuron, and an action potential is always the same. It never changes. It's always the same, no matter where you find it. So that is the language of the nervous system. So if the language is always the same, namely an action potential, how is it that you can understand different senses? What allows you to appreciate the difference between sound and light stimulus if each of those stimuli are producing action potentials and every action potential is identical? How is that possible? And that's because different parts of the brain receive those action potentials. So if there is action potentials going through the occipital lobe, what is going to be the sensation that you have? It's going to be vision. If those same signals go to the primary auditory cortex, what is your sensation going to be? It's going to be hearing, right? Even though the language is exactly the same. Or if you have action potentials going to the post-central gyrus, what is going to be the sensation? Will it be hearing? No. Will it be vision? No. It will be what? Feeling on some part of your body depending on where it went, and you can tell, okay, by what? Looking at that homuncular diagram. Okay, so you have all these different senses because information is going to different parts of the brain, and previously in this lecture I told you an important part of the brain that directs that activity to the proper lobe, whether it's going to the temporal lobe, occipital lobe, or even the parietal lobe. What was that part? It's the thalamus, part of the diencephalon. That's right, part of the diencephalon. That's why that thalamus is so important. Right, so if for whatever reason, if there are signals that enter your ear, right, and stimulate auditory nerves, and it goes into the thalamus, but the thalamus tells it to go to the occipital lobe, okay, what is your sensation going to be, even though the stimulus is coming in your ear? Is going to be visual. You'll have some kind of visual experience. It won't make any sense unless you grew up with it that way, maybe. But it's the part of the brain that receives those action potentials that determines what senses we can appreciate, okay? Okay, so that's why I have on the word slide, parietal lobe, primary sensory cortex for touch, pressure, pain, right? And you can see that right here. Temporal lobe, auditory and olfactory areas. What is the olfactory sense? That's smell. Yeah, olfaction is smell. Occipital lobe is vision, right? And Wernicke's area is kind of right between the temporal lobe and occipital lobe. That's the ability to recognize and understand spoken words, but not speaking, right? Not speaking. What's the area for speaking? Is it motor or sensory? Speaking is motor. So what lobe is that going to be in? Frontal lobe. And does anybody know the sub area of the frontal lobe for speech? That is Broca's area, Broca's area. Okay. Okay, white matter. What the heck is white matter? Anybody tell me what white matter is once again? It is myelinated axons that are going someplace, carrying information from one part of the brain to another. Right? And so we have, so if it's in the central nervous system, white matter are tracts. Okay, so I see some tracts right here. There are ascending and descending tracts in the spinal cord, bringing information up to the spinal cord or down out to the periphery. Okay, or there are tracts in the brain as well, because that's central nervous system. Okay, so gray matter is superficial on in the cortex, right? This is nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and where do you see white matter? Deep inside the cortex. All right, and let's see, what else do we have? We got some dark areas here, 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 and here. All right, so dark areas, just like the gray matter, are nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So these are what we call nuclei. I think your book still likes to call these the basal ganglia, but they're really nuclei inside the brain. And we notice what is separating these dark areas. What do you see? Come on, cursor. Right through here. Oh, yeah, nice. Right through here. All right, so I see some white matter. So there are some, like, wires or axons that are taking information from the motor cortex down to the spinal cord to control a bunch of your body. So this is what we call the internal capsule. The internal capsule is this white matter right between the basal nuclei. And that's important for what kind of information? Efferent or afferent information? Okay, here it is right here. It is, since it is going down to skeletal muscle, it is, and skeletal muscle are effectors, it's an efferent pathway, right? So here's an efferent pathway going down to the spinal cord. Okay, that's not exactly the slide that I wanted to show you. Okay, here I see some nerve signals coming up the spinal cord, coming in from the eye, going into the thalamus, and the thalamus then does what? Directs it to the proper part of the brain, depending on where the signals are coming from. Okay, these kind of fibers, right, so they're just myelinated axon, these are what we call projection fibers. Projection fibers take information from an inferior part of the a central nervous system to a superior part. That's what a projection fiber does, right? So it has a vertical orientation. So tracts in the internal capsule, like I just showed you, between the basal nuclei, those are projection fibers. We can have other fibers that share information from one gyrus to another, right? And those are going to be myelinated axons. That's what we call association tracts. Association tracts don't go up and down within the central nervous system. They don't go from right to left hemisphere. They stay within the same hemisphere, sharing information between gyri in the same hemisphere of the cortex. Okay, there's something that I do want to show you on this diagram right here. Here's a nice superior view. of the cerebral cortex. And again, I can see gyri and sulci all over the place, but I see a very large depression right here, right? And so that's what we call the longitudinal fissure. It's separating the right from the left hemispheres. So you might be wondering, how is it that the right side of your brain knows what the left side is thinking? Well, it can't share information through the longitudinal fissure, but there are tracts that go from right to left, and where they go from right to left, okay, is in something that we call a commissural pathway. And a really good picture of a commissural pathway, if we look over here, this is it. I don't see any convolutions, right, in this part of the brain. This is what we call the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum is for sharing information from the right and left side of the brain. So that is a commissural tract. All right, so when we come back next time, we're going to talk about cerebellum and spinal cord. Mostly spinal cord. Ooh, no, we got to talk about some chambers inside the brain. Okay, so that's it for today. Sign the sign-in sheet, please. And start to do your studying so you could ask me some good questions about the brain next time. There you go.